content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello and welcome to the September 2013 edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm your host, George Douglas. Thanks so much for joining me. This monthly program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons, all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. The Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you'd like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that later in this program. This program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. In fact, all of them that we talk about are available from the library for you today. The library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well, both digital and even some cassette. Still available. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state. If you are not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of this program about that as well. This month, we'll take a look at the most popular books checked out during the month of August 2013 and a few books that were very popular in the spring as well. We're going to begin the program tonight with looking at the new book that is out, relatively new book out, called The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Now, of course, as you may know, that Robert Galbraith is a pseudonym for J.K. Rowling, of course, the author of the incredible Harry Potter series that's been so successful. I'm going to read from a review that was done by cultural critic Julia Keller. Human nature being what it is, a swampy mess of meanness, envy, and spite, in case you were wondering, are we surprised that a lot of people would have been thrilled if The Cuckoo's Calling were a terrible book? Or to put it another way, hasn't J.K. Rowling just had enough success already, and isn't it time that she got her comeuppance? Well, the answers to the aforementioned questions are respectively, not really, perhaps, and maybe so. But the answer to the most important question of all is The Cuckoo's Calling a good book? The answer is simple. Yes, it's terrific. This mystery novel featuring a quasi-disabled military veteran, his clever secretary, a rich, troubled beauty who may have been murdered but who just as likely may have been plummeted to her death in a suicidal swoon, and an attendant swarm of hypocritical possers and annoying hangers-on, is a rich, involving chronicle of contemporary celebrity culture. And it's a nifty whodunit to boot. If Charles Dickens and Agatha Christie had briefly shacked up, their love child might very well have been Robert Galbraith. Except that Galbraith, of course, doesn't exist. It's a pseudonym cooked up by Rowling, one of the most successful authors in history. And if she had her way, we wouldn't know that, and she would be free to write more mysteries under the name Galbraith, minus the burden of her success as the creator of the Harry Potter books and the worldwide phenomenon thereof. Now, to Rowling's displeasure, her secret recently was leaked by the gabby spouse of an employee of the London law firm to whom she had entrusted it, and the subsequent publicity instantly catapulted The Cuckoo's Calling from non-selling obscurity into global bestsellerdom. All of which adds a challenge to the evaluative process of any critic attempting to render an impartial judgment of The Cuckoo's Calling. Can you read the novel without the willowy shadow of Rowling falling across every page? Once you know that is, just as you can't unring a bell, you can't unlearn the fact that Rowling wrote it. I would argue, the critic says, that like it or not, we always read with the author's biography in mind. We make judgments about a book's creator even before we crack open or boot up the first page. Most of the time, we don't know much about the author beyond the thumbnail sketch and tiny photo on the inside cover flap. Still, we have expectations based on the writer's appearance, apparent age, sex, hairstyle, country of origin, life experience, and so forth. There's no such thing as a pure reading experience. We are all awash in personal prejudices and preoccupations and suppositions at all times, based on the writer's biography and our own as well. When a writer poses with her or his cat, for instance, I am predisposed against the contents. But that's just me, says the critic here, Julia Keller. Now on with discussion about the book, The Cuckoo's Calling. Despite its great length and despite the fact that Rowling needs another hit about as much as Bill Gates needs another billion, is a masterful novel, the kind of big, noisy, busy, beautiful book in which it is so easy and so pleasurable to become enmeshed. The characters are fascinating and true. The London setting is rendered with such visceral sensory precision that you will find yourself reaching automatically for an umbrella. And the mystery at its heart, did Lula Landry jump or was she pushed? Ultimately becomes heartbreaking. Seasoned mystery readers may figure it out before the final revelation, but the real joy in engaging with The Cuckoo's Calling lies in the journey, not the destination. The book's protagonist is Cormoran Strike, an ex-soldier with a mostly missing leg who hobbles along. The verb is correct, both literally and financially, as a private detective. Professional prospects are not promising for him. He is a limping man in a creased shirt, the narrator notes, a man whose conscience, once firm and inelastic, had been weakened by repeated blows of fate. But when the sister of one of Strike's long-deceased school friends said sister, having risen to fame as a sulking model, dies on a sidewalk after a long fall, Strike investigates. The trail snakes through back alleys, nightclubs, limousines, well-appointed homes, and run-down bars. The author's descriptions are stunningly good. In an abandoned apartment, the silence had that slack quality that speaks only if the indifference of uninhabited rooms. Two fashion-obsessed women are both as pristine and polished as life-size dolls recently removed from their cellophane boxes. Rich girl thin, almost hipless in their tight jeans, with tanned faces that had a waxy sheen, especially noticeable on their foreheads. Their long, gleaming dark manes with center partings, the ends trimmed with spirit-level exactitude. To be sure, at times the novel lags. Some of Strike's interrogations go on far too long, becoming a bit tedious, and the title is a real stinker, but in all the important ways, The Cuckoo's Calling is a brilliant achievement, mordantly funny and monumentally absorbing. Life isn't fair. If it were, this book would have been a galloping success long before anyone knew that Rowling had written it. Well, it wasn't, and she did, and that's that. Case closed. Now, this piece first ran in the Printers Row Journal, which was delivered to Printers Row members with the Sunday Chicago Tribune. And the review, once again, was written by Julia Keller. The book, The Cuckoo's Calling, by Robert Galbraith, or Don't Call Me J.K. Rowling. And that book by J.K. Rowling was the most popular book during the month of August at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Now we're going to turn to another very, very popular author that we've talked about a few times on this program, David Baldacci, and one of his latest books, The Hit. Now, this is a review that was written by a fellow named Ray Palin in the spring of this year. In 2012, one of David Baldacci's novels introduced us to a new hero, or anti-hero, as the case may be, in The Innocent, readers had the opportunity to become acquainted with Will Roby, who works directly for the U.S. government in a capacity outside of intelligence organizations like the FBI and the CIA, as well as the military. Roby possesses a unique skill set that has earned him renown as a stone-cold hitman who will stop at nothing to finish whatever mission he has been assigned. Now, in The Innocent, Roby is involved in a hit that goes wrong and causes him to go on the run with a 14-year-old super genius girl who has earned his protection. He evades any serious damage to his reputation, and all seems to end well for the him at the book's conclusion. Enter Baldacci's latest novel, The Hit, and that's the book that we're talking about on this program. And Roby finds himself being handed the most difficult assignment of his career. He is tasked with eliminating a former colleague and trainee of his, Jessica Reel. Now, Reel apparently has gone rogue. It seems that she is operating under unknown orders and taking out members of their own agency. When two high-profile government intelligence types are assassinated, there is nothing Roby can do except prepare for the most difficult target he has ever had to chase, someone who is all but his equal in every possible way. Reel is on to Roby and sends him text messages that seem intent on taunting him. She recognizes this as a game of cat and mouse and is hopeful to come out on top. The messages continue, some worded in a special code that only Roby would understand. It is here where he realizes that she may not be an actual traitor, but could possibly be on a private mission to expose high-ranking officials who have a deadly hidden agenda. Roby and Reel are cut from the same cloth. Both of them are loners who realize there can only be one winner in any contest. Now, as he continues his pursuit of her, it becomes more of a matter of satisfying his own curiosity about what actually may be her motives for killing. Each chapter presents another violent encounter or plot-twisting revelation that will leave readers breathless while continuing to keep them guessing. Roby uses all of his guile and experience to get to the truth of the matter and comes face to face with an internal threat that may exist high above his own director's pay grade. It seems that not all threats to U.S. security come from radical Islamic fundamentalists, but potentially from within our very own government. This threat, if confirmed, could change the face of the war on terror permanently. What David Baldacci does best is to lay out a landscape of the many named and faceless organizations operating under the guise of homeland security and the dangerous waters that must be traversed when dealing with them. A scorecard may be required to keep straight who is working for whom, and the line between good guy and villain is often blurred beyond recognition. The Hit, as the book is called, is a masterful novel that allows Baldacci to show off his insightful knowledge of the internal machinations that drive our modern government security systems and combines it with his gift for creating edge-of-your-seat suspense that builds with each passing page. That review was written by Ray Palin in April of this year. The book, again, is The Hit, by David Baldacci. It was one of the most popular books this past month to go out the door to our patrons at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Now we're going to turn on to a next book, The Sea, by Robin Carr. The sea, the sea, the sea, it rolled and rolled and called to me. Come in, it said, come in. 13-year-old Sophie is the only girl amongst the surly crew of the Wanderer, made up of three of her uncles and two cousins. Now, they sail across the Atlantic in this boat toward England, the land of Bompey, her grandfather. The sea calls to Sophie, promising adventure and the chance to explore and discover. But the personal journey she takes brings her deeper into a forgotten past than she ever knew she could travel to. Sophie's 13-year-old cousin Cody isn't even sure why his father brought him along on this voyage. Everyone, including his dad, thinks he's nothing but a knucklehead doofus. But behind all the goofing off, he wonders if he has the strength to prove himself to the crew and to his father. Through Sophie's and Cody's travelogues, the amazing experiences of these six wanderers and their perilous journey unfold. Stories of the past and the daily challenges to survive at sea swirl together as the wanderer sails toward its destination and its passengers search for their places in the world. Newbery Award winner Sharon Creech's newest novel is an adventure-filled story of a courageous girl's journey across the ocean and into the memories of her tragic past. Sophie's struggle to reclaim who she is inspires similar exploration from those around her as the crew discovers the joys and trials of belonging to a family. It sounds like a fascinating read, a great book to listen to. It's called The Sea, and it's by Robin Carr. R-O-B-Y-N is the way she spells her name, Robin Carr. And it's available right now at the North Carolina Library for the visually handicapped and for the blind. Right now we're going to turn to an author that has two books who were in the top 10 during the month of August. Her name is Cheryl Woods, and we'll have a brief description of each of these books. The first one is Sandcastle Bay. It's an ocean breeze novel, and by Cheryl Woods. The summary is as follows. In a trade-off she's lived to regret, Emily Castle left home years ago to become an interior designer. The youngest of three sisters, Emily desperately wanted to prove herself. Success, though, came at the cost of leaving behind the man she loved. For Boone Dorset, losing Emily left his heart shattered. But another woman was waiting in the wings. Now a widower with a young son, Boone has a second chance with Emily when a storm brings her home. But with his former in-laws threatening a custody suit, the stakes of loving her are higher than ever. Will fate once again separate them, or is the time finally right for these two star-crossed lovers? Now that is called Sandcastle Bay. It's an ocean breeze novel by Cheryl Woods. And equally popular during the month of August was another Cheryl Woods book entitled Wind Chime Point, also an ocean breeze novel. Facing a personal crisis, ambitious and driven, Gabriella Castle retreats to the welcoming arms of her family. Everything she's worked for has been yanked out from under her, and she seeks the serenity of her grandmother's home on the North Carolina coast. With difficult decisions to make about her future, the last thing she wants is an unexpected love. Wade Johnson fell for Gabby the first time he saw her. It's not the only time he's found himself in the role of knight in shining armor, but Gabby isn't looking for a rescuer. To get her to stay, Wade will need a whole lot of patience and gentle persuasion, and maybe the soothing sound of wind chimes on a summer breeze. And the title of this book is Wind Chime Point, and the author, once again, is Cheryl Woods. I think you'll enjoy this one, too. And you're listening to Heard Any Good Books Lately from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we're going to turn to a book by Harlan Coben, a very popular author. This one is entitled 6 Years. Harlan Coben, the master of domestic suspense, returns with a standalone thriller in the vein of number one bestsellers Hold Tight, Caught, and Stay Close, that explores the depth and passion of a lost love and the secrets and lies at its heart. 6 years have passed since Jake Fisher watched Natalie, the love of his life, marry another man. Well, 6 years of hiding a broken heart by throwing himself into his career as a college professor, 6 years of keeping his promise to leave Natalie alone, and 6 years of tortured dreams of her life with her new husband, Todd. But 6 years haven't come close to extinguishing his feelings, and when Jake comes across Todd's obituary, he can't keep himself away from the funeral. There he gets the glimpse of Todd's wife he's hoping for. But she is not Natalie. Whoever the mourning widow is, she's been married to Todd for more than a decade, and with that fact, everything Jake thought he knew about the best time of his life, a time he has never gotten over, is turned completely inside out. As Jake searches for the truth, his picture-perfect memories of Natalie begin to unravel. Mutual friends of the couple either can't be found or don't remember Jake. No one has seen Natalie in years. Jake's search for the woman who broke his heart and who lied to him soon puts his very life at risk as it dawns on him that the man he has become may be based on carefully constructed fiction. Harlan Coben once again delivers a shocking page-turner that deftly explores the power of past love and the secrets and lies that such love can hide. The book is called 6 Years by the very popular author Harlan Coben. And speaking of very popular authors, now we're going to take a look at the latest book by Stephen King. It's called Joyland. The usual portal for wickedness and darkness in modern American horror fiction is youthful sexuality. Surging hormones summon demons. That's why big-breasted babysitters, once they've tucked the kids in and phoned their boyfriends to tell them to sneak over, had best keep an eye out for slashers on the stairs. Well, that's why campgrounds full of teenagers in shorts so often lure scar-faced intruders from the woods. Who are these monsters? The thwarted and the spurned, their psyches warped by repression and rejection. They feed for a while on others' erotic vitality, but are ultimately defeated by these same energies in the form of some brave lass or lad who drives a stake or fires a lucky shot, restoring health and order to the world. This is the basic pattern behind Joyland, Stephen King's nostalgic new summer novel about the adventures of a lovelorn college boy in a haunted southern amusement park. The book delivers chills, not shocks, and is silly scary in the manner of yarn that a sophomore might tell a freshman while toasting marshmallows around a fire. It's an exercise in mock gothic Americana, whose tone is more important than its plot, mostly because it barely has a plot, only occasional drafts of chilly menace. For most of the book, there's not even a villain, just a diffuse sense of fairground creepiness that takes the place of a specific evildoer. Our all-American hero is Devin Jones, a sensitive boy who's since become a man and wants to tell us about that crazy time back in the innocent 1970s when he crossed a developmental threshold, simultaneously losing his virginity and gaining a mournful sense of life's fragility. Devin, who dreamed of being a novelist but ended up as a writer for magazines, comes across as a version of King himself, which lends his narration a winking, intimate quality. The reader suspects Devin's reminiscences of his formative summer at the carnival, called Joyland, stand for the sentimental education of the famous author of spooky novels. Joyland is a quaint, old-fashioned establishment that offers rickety rides, rigged games of skill, and other lurid but finally tame versions, including a tunnel of love, like makeout spot, the horror house, it's called. It was the scene of a murder a few years earlier when someone still at large and possibly lurking, killed a young woman named Linda Gray and threw her body from a rattly car onto the dark tracks. Her restless ghost has never left the scene, sometimes materializing in souvenir pictures taken by a crew of girl photographers who give the park a naughty, sexy vibe. For Devin, the ghost is an instant source of intrigue and a welcome distraction from his obsession with an unavailable girl back home. This is fairly light stuff, but what adds a layer of interest is King's affection for the slang and customs of the Midway. King is an amateur anthropologist of carny life, relishing the rituals and folkways of a class on its way to near extinction. I learned the talk, I learned the geography, both above and below ground. I learn how to run a joint, take over a shy, and award plushies to good-looking points. A ride in this lingo is a spree, and a contest that's stacked against the player is a butcher's game. A bathroom is, for some reason, a Doniker. Between the lines is an implied critique of the sanitized corporate Disney-style amusements that have supplanted the grassroots titillations of an earlier, cruder era. Through Devon, who senses that Joyland's days are numbered, King is lamenting the disappearance of a certain type of candid hucksterism, not all that different in spirit from pulp fiction. Both forms of entertainment offer audiences the same delightfully democratic, cheap thrills. As Devon learns from the masters of the trade who adopt him into their fraternity, the corny seductions of the carnival play on an abiding human desire to be honestly manipulated and charmingly ripped off. A failure with girls who seem to find him bland, he could erotically profit from this wisdom, but his gallant good nature inhibits him, which may be related to his subsequent failure to make it as a novelist. Devon's true knack is cheering up the kiddies, especially while costumed as a huge dog, which in the parlance is known as wearing the fur. It's a noble calling, as Devon's boss explains to him in a rather wooden speech that may as well be King's own manifesto as a slinger of the ink. This is a badly broken world full of wars and cruelty and senseless tragedy. Every human being who inhabits it is served his or her portion of unhappiness and wakeful nights. Given such sad but undeniable facts of the human condition, you have been given a priceless gift this summer. You are here to sell fun. There's not a lot more to Joyland than that, good fun. Even the impotent slayer of young women, once he's unmasked by freshly deflowered Devon, who's finally discovered his male mojo thanks to a worldly older woman, is offered as a frightened object of pity. The novel is like a plump wad of cotton candy. It fills the mouth with fluffy sweetness that quickly dissolves when the reader starts to chew. That's by design. King's ambition this time around isn't to snatch us and hold us in his grasp, but to loft us up high, then briskly set us down the way a Ferris wheel does. Or a first love. Walter Kern is the author of this particular review. He's a national correspondent for The New Republic. There were three other very popular books this past month at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. We won't have time to get into them. Maybe we'll do that next time. One was called Guilt, an Alex Delaware novel by Jonathan Kellerman. The next one was called Night Moves by Randy Wayne White, and Last Man Standing by Cindy Gerard. Those were all very popular during the month of August, and we'll get into a review of those next time. And that's all we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately. I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed the program. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search for North Carolina Library for the Blind or call toll-free 1-888-388-2460. You can also use the same numbers and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It is that wonderful organization that sponsors this monthly feature on books. This program is intended for a print and visually handicapped audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after the broadcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.